Another week, another podcast. I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk. Coming up, Sleaze 2.0. We discuss email smear campaigns, dodgy spin doctoring, and the anatomy of a web-created political scandal.
People like you and me, who've set the agenda in the past for news and opinion, are no longer fully in control the way we were. There are new kids in town, and I think we're heading for the first ever blogging general election.
We hear from Andrew Neil about the latest crisis to hit New Labour and ask, will politicians ever truly get the blogosphere? Also in the podcast, Jeremy Bowen comes under fire after the BBC Trust criticises his coverage of the Gaza conflict. We analyse the implications for the BBC newsroom. And as Nipplegate engulfs ITV, we'll look at British Broadcasting's latest storm in a D-cup. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, in honour of Sir Clement Freud, our panel this week will attempt to get through the show without too much repetition or deviation. Stephen Brook is Media Guardian's press and publishing correspondent. I fancy you probably hadn't heard of Clement Freud, Brookie.
Incorrect. I, in fact, went to a live taping of Just a Minute in Edinburgh last year. It was one of the best things I did.
James Robinson is The Observer's media editor, perhaps more the Paul Merton of the panel.
Merton, I'd say, well, Frank Skinner, surely.
Yeah, yes, Frank Skinner, yes, much better. Now, with Samantha on hand to keep the scores, not sure if that's the right game show, let's begin.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on Guardian.co.uk.
And this week's news has been dominated by a story of the dark arts of media manipulation. Like so many other media firestorms, it started with an email and ended with the resignation of one of Gordon Brown's most trusted aides, Damien McBride. The emails were leaked to the political blogger Guido Fawkes, who himself hawked them around the press, which willingly obliged by splashing with the story over an otherwise barren Easter weekend. Now, this story, of course, comes off the back of several weeks of sniping about ministers' bogus expenses claims and all the rest of it. Earlier, I spoke to Andrew Neil, the presenter of the BBC's Daily Politics programme, who had an interesting role in the affair.
We had Derek Draper and Guido Fawkes, also known as Paul Staines, on the Daily Politics last month to argue about blogging and about their respective sites and about the importance of blogging. Of course, it quickly turned into a wrestling match. And in the process of the interview, I asked Derek Draper if there was any official Labour contact with his site, if the Labour Party was officially involved. And he denied it. And then Guido Fawkes said, but I have information that links Damien McBride to you and your blogging activities. And that was then the first hint of what Guido Fawkes had up his sleeve. And also, as we subsequently learned, an indication that Mr. Draper was perhaps, in answering my question, economical with the truth.
As a former newspaper editor yourself, what do you think this tells us about the state of blogging and its relation to political journalism?
I think it tells what the Americans call the mainstream media, MSM, both broadcasters and newspapers and magazines alike, that blogging is making a big difference to the way news and opinion and scoops are disseminated. We've seen it with the Daniel Hannan YouTube appearance when he spoke in the European Parliament, which the main broadcasters decided wasn't a story. The bloggers and the internet decided otherwise. It became a huge international story as a result. And we've seen that the bloggers can now get scoops that the rest of the newspapers and the broadcasters have to follow up. In many ways, people like you and me, who've set the agenda in the past for news and opinion, are no longer fully in control the way we were. There are new kids in town, and it's a democratization in many ways of the process of news and analysis and opinion. I welcome it, and I think we're heading for the first ever broadband blogging general election.
What about this idea that Labour seems to have lost its knack when it comes to spin? Because you talked about control there and loss of control. They seem to have tried to control this affair but failed miserably.
Yes, there's been a lack of subtlety, and I think, you know, taking a sledgehammer to crack a nut in many ways. You know, I think if you just do it for so long, in the end you become stale at it. Plus, I think we are more up to their tricks. I mean, I think there's no question when Mr. Blair came to power in 97, with Alistair Campbell at his side. But the mainstream media was kind of intimidated by Mr. Blair's popularity, which was enormous, and by Mr. Campbell's, rather robust methods of trying to control the press, backed up by Mr. Mandelson, who used to call broadcasters almost the moment a major newscast had begun to complain about the running order or about a particular slant on a story. I think we've just got a bit long in the tooth about it all. We know their tricks. We're less intimidated by them. Indeed, we're a bit bored by them, and we stand up a bit more to them.
Now, Derek Draper said that he wanted to set up this new website, Red Rag, to counter the effect of successful right-wing websites like Guido Fawkes's and Ian Dales' sites, which are enormously successful. Why does it seem to be that the left can't seem to do this in the same way as the right can? Is it just us soft lefties are just too nice to do gossip properly?
No, not at all. I don't think soft lefties are any nicer than soft righties. I'm not too keen on either of you. But I think the reason is, one is that, and you see it in America too, where it's the mirror image. In the United Kingdom, the right's in opposition, the left is in government. And it's always much more fun to be blogging when you're in opposition than it is when you're in government. And blogging has grown up when we've only ever known a Labour government and a conservative opposition. So it doesn't surprise me that the bloggers, the successful ones, are overwhelmingly right, centre-right leaning. And you see the opposite in America, where during the Bush years, by far the most interesting, the most controversial, the most scoop-breaking bloggers were on the centre-left, were more Democrat-inclined than Republican-inclined. And that's because the Democrats were in opposition as well. And the one thing we do know is that blogging is not an establishment occupation.
Andrew Neil, deep in a Westminster bunker there somewhere by the sound of it. Stephen Brook and James Robinson are here with me in the studio still, and we've been joined by Guardian.co.uk's senior political correspondent and Orwell Prize-nominated blogger, Andrew Sparrow. Now, Andrew, the government seems once again to have been tripped up by an attempt to manage the media agenda, I guess, except this time it was the digital media that they were trying to manage, and they sort of blew it, really, didn't they?
I don't think this says a lot about the Labour and the digital media. It's about dirty tricks, and the emails that Damien McBride was writing were proposing really vicious, nasty personal slurs with kind of no basis in truth against senior opposition. And if that had been happening in the old media, I mean, if someone had found a spin doctor trying to plant stories like that in newspaper diaries 15 years ago before the internet, then the outrage would have been just as significant. So it wasn't just about the media, it was about kind of nastiness and brutality in politics.
The weird thing about this, Andrew, though, is that the story didn't really come out as a story at all. It was just gossip and innuendo, because Guido Fawkes on his website just hinted at it. Then he hawked it around the papers and they sort of hinted at it. And then before you knew it, Damien McBride had resigned.
Well, by that stage, Guido hadn't sold it. He'd given them to the paper. He's got an interesting piece in The Spectator today where he explains his thinking on that, because we know from the Telegraph of...
He even suggests in that piece that a figure of £20,000 was suggested in relation to the Telegraph. He's quite coy about who suggested the £20,000. He did think about getting money for those emails, didn't he?
He makes the point that he was worried about what sort of legal cover he's got, because we still don't know the provenance of these emails. I mean, it looks as though someone's been sort of hacking into them. That's what I'm a bit cautious about.
That's Derek Draper's line, isn't it?
I'm a bit cautious about even using the term leak, because leak suggests that someone has passed them over, and we don't know that is the case. Guido seemed to take the view that, he said he took legal advice on this. It's not clear whether this was a couple of lawyers he knows down the pub or whether he sort of paid for it. But
it's
he was
a strange
advised
sort of journalist, though, blogger or not, who gives away the scoop of the year to a newspaper, which it, in effect, isn't that what Paul Staines has done?
Why didn't he put it on his website?
Well, that's the question. I mean, that illustrates the power of the old media, isn't it? It is incredibly ironic that a blogger who hinted at the story, put a picture of Damien McBride up with a crosshead superimposed on his face, then can only get the story running properly when it's in an established newspaper. It does seem curious, doesn't it? Why didn't he just... I don't know. Why didn't he just publish?
Well, the thing about the blogging as an industry is it is a lost leader, and no one makes significant money from blog. Even sort of Guido Fawkes, who carries advertising, and Ian Dale, the two big sort of sole operator bloggers, and they make sort of... I think in Dale's case, it's around 10,000. I mean, it's a bit of money. It's nice to have, but it's not a professional living. But what they do is on the back of that, they've established a profile that gets them onto media all the time, gets them sort of speaking gigs all over the place. Blogging is a lost leader for punditry, basically.
And that's why he would ask for money. But I also wonder whether he felt he didn't have the legal backup to publish it himself, whereas newspapers could.
Because they can
armies of in-house lawyers, yeah, who can, and if they need to defend them, they can afford to do so. So I wonder if that was a motivating factor.
I think so. The point he made is that if you're trying to run a public interest defence for using leaked material, then if you're taking money for it, you're on dodgy ground. Mm. And that is his explanation as to why he gave it away.
One other interesting aspect of all of this is the fake shock and horror that political journalists have been expressing, when we all know this is the lingua franca of political journalism from time immemorial. Stephen, what's your take on that?
Yeah, there's a bit of a kind of feeling, isn't there, that all they got caught, because isn't New Labour littered with these kind of spin attacks on mainly their own ministers? And Mo Molan went through this where, you know, someone suggested that she wasn't right to be in the job of Northern Ireland Secretary and she had to leave. And then there was that extraordinary Ruth Kelly incident with a 3 a.m. briefing in a hotel lobby that she was going to be leaving the ministry. So this is significant to the extent that the public, who don't pay attention to politics that often, and certainly not over the Easter weekend, they'll be vaguely aware that this has gone on, but this drip, drip, drip adds up. And of course, now, throughout the forthcoming election campaign, the Conservatives can bring it up anytime they want.
Well, the broadband blogging general election, as Andrew Neil suggested it would be. Andrew?
I think these were sort of qualitatively different. You're right about negative briefing and smears. These were, A, very, very explicit and sort of personal and sexual. And the full emails themselves haven't been published. And one of the reasons for that is you just couldn't get them into a family newspaper. They are pornographic in content.
Stephen, I can see you're bursting to get in here.
Was this just some weird letting off steam on his part? Because, A, you can't establish a blog if you're actually a senior advisor to Gordon Brown and pretend that it's some kind of blogging exercise in the likes of Guido Fawkes. And, B, you can't put up material like that on a blog without bearing the consequences.
Well, that's presumably part of the flawed logic, isn't it? What you just look at these sites, and they are full of things that you would never publish in a newspaper because you would get sued. And I assume that they saw it as an opportunity to spread rumours that you couldn't possibly... You mentioned diary stories, you know, 10, 15 years ago. You couldn't have written the contents of those email in any British newspaper. That's why they were trying to harness the internet to get this stuff out there, wasn't it? And that's how the internet changes the sort of parameters of debate, in a sense.
A side angle to this, of course, is that it's brought up old friends who we thought we'd forgotten. Derek Draper, back in the news.
Derek Draper, yeah. Should I declare an interest here? I do know Derek quite well, as lots of people do.
Show us the emails.
Yeah.
I'll step in then, because I don't know him at all. The man is clearly a fool.
Well, he's not a fool, but I mean, he's...
He's
the innocent party in a way.
I don't know about that.
Described Derek Draper as innocent.
Well,
I read a very interesting a quote about Derek Draper, which suggested that normally, most of us, as we get older, we get a bit wiser. He seems to get more naive.
Yeah. Difficult to comment, really, on that.
It was a friend of his who said that.
No, I think, I mean...
Was that you?
Yeah, it was me. I think, I mean, on one level, he received some emails, and we still... It may be the case that he did have his emails hacked into, and he responded... You know, the thing that Hunk really did for him was the fact that he responded to the emails by saying, brilliant,
yeah,
Damien. Now, that was his mistake. But then how many times... I mean, sorry, I don't want to be cast as the defender of Derek Draper, how many times have we had emails from people that we're trying to build a relationship with or get on side and just thought, that's not going to work, but then just replied, brilliant, yeah, fantastic. Yeah. I mean, you know, this is minutiae, isn't it? But I mean, Derek's reputation does precede him, doesn't it? That's the problem. And so when you see that Derek's been involved in something like this, you automatically assume there is more to it than meets the eye. That's the problem, isn't it, Andrew?
Well, one of the curious things I found about this was that Derrida came into this because Labour Party for a long time had been worried about their presence on the internet, and he bowled up last summer and said, look, I'm the man to sort it out. I'll be your Ian Dell. Ian Dell sort of recently said he was horrified at the idea that people might say that he was the Conservatives' Derek Draper. And he said, I'll set up a Conservative Home, and he set up Labour List, which is, it's not half as good as Conservative Home, but it's a functional website, and Red Rag was going to be their Guido Fawkes.
Isn't that the problem there? Because you cannot, as Andrew Neil alluded to, you can't have a website like that when you're in government, because the main thing about being in government is defending your record, not attacking. And if you wanted a forum for debate, genuine debate in the party, to come up with new ideas and refresh, the Labour Party, it cannot be linked to the establishment of the Labour Party, can it? It has to grow organically, and that was their mistake, wasn't it?
Up to a point, I mean, I think Andrew Neil's explanation of where we are in relation to the mainstream media and the blogosphere was very good, but I'm not convinced that left or the government party in the UK is incapable of good blogging. There are good sort of left-wing bloggers. John Prescott, of all people, has started blogging.
He is the new boy on the scene.
Dan Campbell's blog. Alistair Campbell's blog is great. Really, okay. Isn't it?
Next, left, the Fabian Society have got a good blog, which isn't slavishly on message. It sort of criticised the government, but from a sort of constructive point of view. So there are other sort of bloggers out
there. But Labour List was, you had ministers writing on there. And doesn't that change the way it's perceived? It's got the unofficial backing of the official backing of the Labour Party.
Yeah, it's kind of slavishly loyal, which is one of its weaknesses. And
it'll get a whole lot better when the Tories get in, won't it?
Yeah, probably.
But just one tiny point on this is what it shows is the weakness of the blogosphere, because they can't survive without the mainstream media to... them along.
It's an interesting point. Slavishly loyal is not something we could ever be accused of on this podcast. I should point out there's one final fact that we should mention before we leave this subject aside. Damien McBride's age.
34 or 5.
Oh dear, oh dear. Not looking good, Damien.
Well, doesn't wear it well.
Thank you very much.
All those late night briefings.
Absolutely. is that what you call them? Thanks very much to Andy Sparrow for joining us. You can stay up to date with this story, of course, at guardian.co.uk/politics. I'm Matt Wells. You're listening to Media Talk. And before we go any further, I have a very important public service announcement. On top of our Sony nomination, which of course we mentioned last week, our audio outputs made the shortlist for a prestigious Webby Award in their podcast category. Well, you mentioned here. There are two awards up for grabs, one voted for by a committee and another by the public. That's where you come in. So please, and I say this not only in my role as Guardian's head of audio, but also as your charming host, show your support by going to webbyawards.com and follow the link through to the public vote. If you don't, Emily Bell will come around and beat you up. While we're on the subject of podcasts, here's another one for you.
I'm Aditya Chakraborty, and on this week's business podcast, we're all about confidence, tricksters, and economic forecasting. We go on Springwatch to find those green shoots of recovery that politicians keep talking about. Plus, our man in New York fills us in on Ponzi schemes and the latest twist in a case against a Texan billionaire, Alan Stanford. And
the whole world car industry needs some sort of revitalisation. It needs to be restructured around environmental measures. And that just isn't happening. There are these little things happening around the edge, but basically we're looking to restore business as usual. What we should be really saying is here's a good crisis, is a good opportunity to redraw the lines in the car industry, put a huge push into electric cars or some kind of technology that will be much greener.
Running on empty, we look at the beleaguered car industry in America and the UK and ask, is it still roadworthy? So join me and my panellists Larry Elliott and Deborah Hargreaves on The Business, available now on iTunes or at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Okay, now time to round up a few of the other media headlines from the last week. James, the BBC's Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen has been censured by the BBC Trust. What's this about?
Yeah, mainly about his comments, sort of contextualising the 1967 war. I mean, it's notoriously difficult ground, isn't it, the Arab-Israeli conflict, for all sorts of reasons. But what this illustrates, chiefly, is the problem the BBC have and has had since the sort of post-Mar senior reporters were asked to explain the news, analyse the news, as well as report the news. This is the problem, because you can't do that without offering up some comment. I think.
Yes.
It's very difficult to do that. And that's the problem, you know, when you've got...
Because you give a perspective, you give
it, and it has to be, and it inevitably will be, a personal view. It's very difficult not to do that. And they've got their big star reporters, and Jeremy Bowen's very good. I mean, very good, but extremely authoritative. But it's almost bound to happen.
And the other interesting thing, of course, about this is that he was appointed after... another row about Middle East coverage that emanated, and that was a result of the now infamous Balin report, still not published.
Yeah, still not published, and there was a campaign, wasn't there, against the journalist in question, whose name escapes me. And Bowen was regarded as, you know, someone with the experience to offer a balanced perspective, but you can't win. We all know you can't win when it comes to the Arab-Israeli conflict because of the incredibly vocal lobbies on both sides of the argument.
Which is why...
I was just going to say, the journalist you mentioned, it was Ola Guerin.
Ola Guerin, was another great journalist. Yeah.
Which is why this ruling by the BBC Trust is so dangerous and why I'm so cross about them having done it, because it weakens the whole BBC News output. And I speak as someone who will no longer have BBC 10 o'clock news in my house because it is so full of posers. But Jeremy Bowen is one of their best journalists, and I think that they have undermined him massively.
Yeah.
Because if you read through what he has actually been found to be in breach on, and he is commenting about the Israel War of Independence in 1948, and then he's also talking about the Six-Day War in 1967, offering a historical perspective, and the Trust has said that he's been loose with his language. But now the Trust has handed people who want to criticise BBC's coverage of the Middle East, and there are lots of those, a weapon with which to hit the BBC over the head day in and day out, until eventually Jeremy Bowen will have to get another job.
There's an interesting quote in the Independence report of this story on their front page on Thursday's edition from a unnamed senior BBC journalist, James, who said, quote, "There's no love lost between staff and the BBC Trust. We see them as a hostile body, and they seem to be in competition with Ofcom to see who can kick us the hardest."
Yeah, well, the BBC Trust will love that. You know, Michael Grade, who set it up, and the Trust, you know, and Sir Michael Lyons will point to that as evidence of just how independent they are. And that's interesting. You know, it's interesting that they feel that way. But that's what the Trust is meant to do, in part. But they are right, because the Trust rules first, and then Ofcom typically rule later on every sort of issue there is, because they take longer to do it. And it seems to me that Ofcom look at what the Trust do, you know, multiply the fine by two, or, you know, use stronger language than the Trust. They take their lead from the Trust. Mm. So, it is a problem having two regulatory bodies.
You sort of hinted at it, Stephen. Do you think it puts Jeremy Bowen's job at risk?
Totally, because the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Ireland have already said that his role is untenable. For what I think are really, really minor breaches that the BBC Trust has ruled on.
God, don't start now. We have managed to go through 3 years of this podcast without ever being lobbied by one side of that conflict or the other.
Which is a miracle.
I just think if you have reporters in very politically contentious situations, you back them or you sack them. Yeah. And the Trust has failed to do that. And it's going to be to the detriment.
All right, well, we'll see what happens. There have been a few good press stories around this week, Stephen. James Murdoch has been hailed as the saviour of newsprint.
It's amazing what a recession will do for press commentary in it, isn't it? I think that the same thing happened in Australia when I was over there last year, where the Journalism Union gave a big award to the main Murdoch executive over there. Suddenly, because the Murdochs are still investing in their papers and haven't gone down the route of mass sackings that so many other print organisations have gone through, people are sort of falling in love with the Murdochs, probably for the first time, a lot of them. And it's interesting, James, I think, is repeating what he did when he came into Sky. He invested a lot into the marketing, and he pushed subscriptions to the horror of the city, which absolutely killed the Sky share price. But what has he done at the Times? He's pushed subscriptions and he's investing in marketing. And I think that he is thinking that whilst his rivals, particularly the Telegraph, will be weakened by the recession. He hopes that News International papers will be in tip-top shape with increased market share when we come out of it.
All change at the Radio Times. Editor Jill Hudson, seen as a very successful editor of the Radio Times. She's gone to your favourite publication.
I've now got to be careful because
The Reader's Digest.
I remember enthusing about the Reader's Digest quite a few pods ago, and then got back to my desk, and about a week later, a Reader's Digest press release turned up with a huge banner, "I devour this magazine." I thought, what fool would possibly have said that? And down below, Stephen Brooke, Media Guardian. what a coup, because she is a star editor and she's won awards for her time at the Radio Times, and Reader's Digest have snaffled her. Interesting Jill Hudson fact, she founded Maxim.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah,
so she's got a huge track record of huge success.
Fat fans.
It worked at the time. Yeah, it was the biggest newspaper. Sorry, it was the biggest magazine in the world for a while, Maxim.
Yeah.
But now probably Reader's Digest is.
You're not a Maxim. Are you a Maxim man, Jim?
Oh no, God,
don't
no.
be ridiculous. No. It's far too.
I'm far too sophisticated. I can't believe you hadn't noticed that, man.
No, absolutely.
He's got every arena. No, he's got every the face from the first decade or something.
No, I haven't. I was never that cool. Believe me.
I'm sure you were. Just before we end the section, last week we talked about the G20 protest video, and the point was made that in this camera phone world, the police can't get away with the bully boy tactics of the past. Not so on the blog, says Hi Frank. Contrary to your assessment that citizen journalists are going to make the police accountable in future, I fear that's not going to happen. The reason is that the Counter-Terrorism Act of 2008 defines photographing a police officer as a terrorist offence, so the police can, if they wish, just arrest anyone who films them.
Just punch them in the face.
Yeah, well, Cora, that'll do for now, I think. For more on all these stories, head to mediaguardian.co.uk. It's customary for us to talk telly for the final part of the show. Brookie, you can always be relied upon when it comes to a quiet night in on the sofa.
So-called life. Title of my autobiography. Yeah.
Doctor Who Easter special.
Yes. Well,
your verdict, please.
I'm giving it 2.5 stars. And out of 5.
Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have known that.
Obviously. I thought derivative, but it had all the sort of bits in the right place, so quite enjoyable. I think I'm in a minority because we did put an organ grinder post up about this, and they really slagged it off ad nauseum about almost everything to do with it. I think, you know, there is a bit of a perception that after a massively successful 10-year Russell T. Davis is repeating himself slightly. I think it's actually more than that. I think that there's been a fundamental misconception about what works best for the program. Because if you remember, for the first 25 years of its existence, it was a serial, had 25-minute episodes, 4-part, 6-part stories. So it was very much built on a series of episodes with cliffhangers that led up to a big finale. And these big one-hour episodes that the BBC sold as being really, like, you know, standards of a Hollywood movie, they're just too rushed and there's not enough in them.
But the reason that they've done them like this is because they wanted to keep hold of David Tennant, but he didn't have enough time to do a full series. So they're stuck with this now for the next 4 specials. And also, they've announced the successor, so I'm all excited. I want to know what the new Doctor Who's going to be like. And I'm a bit bored of, you know, are you still here, David Tennant? Apprentice, enough already?
No, we can't talk about The Apprentice. Can we talk about Britain's Got Talent?
Okay. I haven't watched this. I'm staying away. I shouted.
This has gone
in my house
last
night. No, I'm not watching it. Not watching it. I'm just on principle.
This has been on the NBC Today Show. It is now so huge.
Which bit of it?
Susan.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Susan, the frumpy Scottish
stripper.
No, not the stripper.
Oh, no, sorry.
Yeah, this is Tattlegate. I mentioned it.
This is the rather plain-looking woman who came out with the voice of an angel, the sort of 50, 60-year-old pensioner, never been kissed.
Really?
Anyway, this is on YouTube
really
now. It has been watched by 6 million people.
Not me.
No.
Not one of them.
Oh, you're such a guardianista sometimes, Matt. I'm too good for Britain's Got Talent.
No.
Next, let's talk about Railway Walks on BBC Two.
No, I don't watch that because I don't like Julia Bradbury, who's back on Watchdog.
You are fussy, is she? Actually, I know something you'll like. Can we talk about Panorama?
No, Matt? I don't watch that either because it's gone too damn hard.
No. I made my criticisms of BBC News, but they had a fantastic episode of Panorama, Current Affairs at its best, earlier this week about people who had lost their jobs from Woolworths. They followed about 5 of them. And, you know, some of these were couples, whole families, and both parents had worked for Woolworths out of a job. What do you do? What do you do when you're out of a job, you've got a mortgage? How do you reorganise your life? How do you look for work?
Ask Derek Draper and Damien McBride.
Yes, absolutely. We should follow them. Let's quickly run through two more. Red Dwarf is back. Sounds like one for you, Brookie. You like these.
Yes, I'm afraid I was on a cycling holiday in Cambridge. So
holiday in Cambridge.
I think that with these kind of things, though, it's a bit of an element of the nostalgia lies. Because we think, oh, Red Dwarf, God, it was fantastic. And
it got 2 million viewers for Dave, so trebles all around there.
Yeah, yeah, it was very smart of them, wasn't it? It's kind of what Channel 5 tried to do with Minder, which is bring back a big
hit. But that was just terrible.
Oh, yeah, at least Red Dwarf's got the same cast.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Newswipe, have we finally found a UK version of The Daily Show?
No. But I do think
Charlie Brooker. You know,
Charlie Brooker is brilliant, but the thing, the Daily Show is about politics, not really new. I mean, I know it does criticise news networks, but I think they're different beasts, really, aren't they?
And I think even Charlie himself would be embarrassed by that little allusion to The Daily Show, because when I interviewed him after he won the British Press Award, which I believe that you played
transmitted it, yes,
cruelly cut to shreds, but anyway. He said he was very surprised that he had won this award, and that if he was the best sort of most incisive thinker on Fleet Street, then something was going wrong somewhere. I do think that television is missing a trick, though, because, you know, who are the great big offenders of the British media? It's the Fleet Street. There should be a, you know, Newswipe should be about the press, not about TV.
All right.
Because it's a rich, loamy soil into.
It's an invitation from the press to the broadcasters. Bring it on, says Brookie. I think it's time there that we draw a veil. To have your say on any of the topics that we've been discussing, go to guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or post a comment on our Facebook wall. We've put a link on both of them for you to vote for us in the Webby's People Voice Awards, so no pressure. My thanks to James Robinson and Stephen Brook for all their hard work. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Goodbye for now.